Today at Reader's Corner, Edward Alden, author of Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In recent years, the powerful and at times unexpected impacts of globalization have sent shockwaves through our country's political, economic, and social systems. The promise that open trade and investment would bring new jobs, economic growth, and price stability has not materialized for many Americans who have seen their standard of living stagnate or diminish. At the same time, there is a widespread disagreement about what our country needs to do to more effectively compete in the current global marketplace. Today's guest, Edward Alden, brings a timely analysis to these issues in his book, Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. In the book, Mr. Alden explains how four decades of U.S. economic and trade policies have led to our current predicament and the very real options we have for a course correction. Failure to Adjust is now out in paperback. Today, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Alden. He is the Bernard L. Schwarz Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former journalist who worked as Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times and for other media outlets. Mr. Alden joins us from the studios of the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. Ted Alden, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be with you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So the title of your book comes from a 1971 report by Nixon assistant and former Bell & Howell CEO Pete Peterson, who warned of the negative consequences of the competitive pressures of the global economy. I think the report was called The U.S. in a Changing World Economy. What did Peterson report to Nixon in that tome?
Yeah, I was pretty astonished when I stumbled across this memo. So President Nixon had appointed Pete Peterson as the first director of something called the White House Council on International Economic Policy, which was supposed to look at U.S. international economic challenges. And basically, the first couple of months, Peterson spent writing this long memo to the president. And he said, look, he said, Mr. President, we are moving into a very different world. For 20, 25 years after the Second World War, we were a pretty self-sufficient economy. We made everything better than almost anyone else in the world. But now the Japanese are back, the Germans are back. You can see these Asian economies that are rising. We are going to move into a hyper-competitive global economy, and we better be prepared to respond and adapt to the challenges that is going to throw up. And the thing that amazed me about the memo is, you know, there are bits of it that are bound. You know, you would say, that could only have been written in 1971. But a lot of it you could read today and say, yeah, that makes sense. And we did not as a country address very many of those challenges.
Now, what's interesting, the more I get to thinking about it and reading your book, you also talk in the book about the 1962 Kennedy plan. I think it was the Trade Adjustment Act. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Now, that obviously preceded the warning that Peterson was giving. So why don't you help us understand how Kennedy in the 60s decides to address this issue of what happens to workers and what happens to companies who get left behind in this globalization of the economy?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting because in a lot of ways, and it's the theme that runs throughout my book, none of this was unexpected. You know, if you look at the economic research tells us that greater global trade is going to be good in general for the countries that engage in it. It will make them wealthier on the whole. And we have lots of examples in our everyday life, right? You know, if you look at the amount of money that the average household spends on clothing, you know, in 1970 it was about 7% of a household budget. Today it's less than 3%. You know, we all know you go to the mall and clothing's really cheap. A lot of that is because of imports. You know, same with television sets and cars and all sorts of other products. So we kind of know, and certainly Kennedy knew back in the early 1960s, trade's generally a pretty good thing. What he argued, though, was, and again, consistent with what the economists tell us, is that there are going to be places that really are the losers from trade. You know, if you're a factory town, I just finished reading Janesville, a wonderful new book by Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein about Paul Ryan's hometown in Wisconsin. There was one GM factory there that was really the heart of the town. If you're a factory town and the main employer goes under because of import competition, that town's really going to hurt. And Kennedy said, look, there are going to be places in the country that are going to get hit hard by trade competition, and we've got to do things to help those places and those individuals. He gave quite a profound speech. He said, look, we cannot pursue a policy, open trade, that we believe to be in the general national interest and then yet let a small percentage of our citizens pay the whole price. And unfortunately, that's really what we ended up doing.
And at one point, you have a chapter where you actually take us through successive presidential administrations, showing how each of them tried to deal with this issue. And I think you take us right on up to the Obama administration, which introduced a bill that was somewhat very similar to the Kennedy bill.
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea behind trade adjustment assistance was okay, so for those people who lose their jobs to import competition or because their factory moves to another country, we really should, as a country, go out of our way to help them make the transition. So that means, you know, generous income support, worker retraining programs, allowances to help them move if they need to relocate to find new work. But the political consensus behind the program was always really weak. In fact, you know, in the first 6 years after Kennedy launched the program, the criteria were so narrow that there wasn't a single American worker who got a dime out of it. There have been times, the late 1970s during the downturn at the end of the Carter administration, when the program got ramped up and was reasonably generous. But by and large, it's never covered more than a fraction of U.S. workers. And President Obama, to his credit, actually made a broader point, which is it really shouldn't matter why people lose their jobs if they're losing them to trade or they're losing them to technology, which accounts for a lot more job loss. We need to have programs in place to help Americans make that transition. The Europeans, Canadians, almost every other advanced economy does a lot more of this sort of assistance than we do here in the United States.
And I get the impression from reading your work on this subject that let's take worker retraining. You seem to say that worker retraining could work, but we don't have enough evidence that it's been implemented long enough and in a robust fashion enough to know whether it really can work.
I mean, I think there are two things that are true from you know, what I wrote in my book and from I've been continuing to work on the subject. One is that I think done properly, worker retraining can make a real difference. There's a fair bit of evidence from Germany, Denmark, other European countries. I've got examples in my book from particularly intensive efforts, particularly involving the auto industry in the 1980s, that were fairly successful. But the other thing that's true is it doesn't work all the time, particularly if people have a hard time moving. You know, sometimes, you know, again, to take the example in this book, Janesville, you know, the General Motors factory paid $28 an hour plus benefits to its employees. There simply weren't any other jobs in the town, no matter what sort of retraining, that were going to pay wages that were as good as that. And so then you get into the much more difficult situation of, are people willing to leave their towns? Are they willing to move elsewhere? And even if they want to, are they able to? I mean, a lot of the job creation in the United States is taking place in the big cities, in Seattle or San Francisco or New York or Washington. You know, anybody who's tried to buy a house or rent an apartment in those places knows how difficult it is to move from a smaller town and city to a much larger city. It's just a very difficult thing to do. So retraining is important, but it's not a panacea, where there are other things that we need to pay attention to.
Can we accurately portray the number of Americans who lose their jobs because of a job going overseas, because a company like Caterpillar starts adding more jobs overseas than it does in the United States, versus how many Americans lose their jobs because of automation?
Not perfectly, and what I have come to think is, you know, if you think about it from the perspective of the employee, you know, say suddenly you're facing import competition from China. What are the options? Well, your company can't meet the competition, so it goes out of business. You lose your job. Option number two. Company has to lower its costs, so it offshores some of the operation to a lower wage country, and some of the employees lose their jobs. Third possibility, wants to keep the jobs in the United States, but has to automate, has to become far more efficient and productive to meet the competition, invest in technology, and some of the workers lose their jobs. So at some level, it's a sort of distinction without a difference, but that said, there has been some really good, I think in some ways transformational research over the last decade, looking at the impact in particular of import competition from China during the 2000s, and it was substantial. The United States lost about a third of its manufacturing employment in the 2000s, about 6 million jobs. That was a huge number. And the best estimates are that import competition from China probably accounted for something like 25 to 40% of that. So a not insignificant chunk of the job loss was trade related. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Edward Alden, author of Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. So let's look at the other side of the coin, the American products that are hitting the shelves in Japan and China. Your book seems to imply, maybe implies an awfully easy way of putting it, that they're not playing fair over there. In the United States, maybe plays too fair.
I think, you know, there is some truth to that. So you know, again, to be clear where I stand on this, I think there are a lot of benefits from trade. And as, you know, U.S. trade representatives all say, look, 95% of the world's customers are outside the United States. And unless we're successful in exporting, we're just going to miss out on an enormous number of opportunities. But it has been a real challenge for the United States to create fair conditions of competition with other countries. I mean, the reality is that the big Asian economies, Japan in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, China over the last 20 years, and a bunch of the smaller Asian economies have been much more mercantilist than the United States is. They've been very focused on export success. They've been focused on building their own national champion companies. They are much more aggressive in using regulations and other tools of the state to discriminate against American or European products. And it's been really hard to fix that problem. I mean, the United States has tried to do it by writing better trade rules. And these are efforts to try to get at some of these less than fair trading practices. But, you know, I think a fair reading of the history is that at best, the United States has been only modestly successful in that effort, that in a lot of cases, we really do end up on the losing end of some of these transactions. I think that's why Donald Trump's message had some real resonance during the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Give us an example of a tool or two that the Japanese might have used in ensuring that U.S. sales are not that significant in Japan.
Well, you know, for a long time, it was regulatory stuff. One of my favorite tales, and Clyde Prestowitz was the original one to write about this, was baseball bats. The United States is the world's leader in aluminum baseball bats, which are used in Little League play around the world. Japanese Little League is a big business. They use aluminum baseball bats. Aluminum is energy intensive. We have a real cost advantage. But they've written a whole set of regulations that has essentially made it impossible to buy American-made aluminum bats for use in Japanese little leagues. It's just regulations written, and they've come up with all sorts of justifications about why the American product is not appropriate. American cars, and you can say American cars aren't perfect for Japanese roads, but you know, a lot of American companies now make very good small cars. That wasn't true in the 70s and 80s, but now there are a lot of good small cars. The import share of the Japanese auto market is still about 3%. They just basically don't buy foreign cars, and a lot of it's kind of informal. Their dealers just don't stock them, and they say Japanese consumers don't want to buy them, and it's pretty hard to go after that. It's not technically a violation of the rules, but the effect of it is it's very hard for the U.S. to make sales.
Well, I grew up at a time when, and I grew up in a neighborhood where unions were strong, and they were always speaking out on this issue of Buy American. And throughout my life, at various times, there would be a campaign here and now about buying American. When I read your book and thought about it a little bit, I thought there's no way that there's any serious effort on the part of Americans, whether it's public officials or consumers, to question imports anymore. Seems like we've kind of rolled over and played dead. And in the meantime, to your point about the Japanese, and I want to talk about the Chinese here in a minute, they continue to play that game that years ago the unions played relatively successfully, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think American consumers like getting a deal, right? They're not that worried about where their products are made. The Buy American stuff has been limited pretty much to sort of government purchases. The unions are a very interesting story, and in a way, kind of quite a tragic story. One of the ironies, you know, you go back to 1962. You mentioned, you know, Kennedy's Trade Act of 1962. The biggest supporters of Kennedy on trade in 1962 were the labor unions. They said, look, hey, we make the best products in the world. We have the best workers. Our import tariffs are generally lower than those of other countries. Trade's going to be a great thing for us. If we can get rid of those barriers, we're going to export a lot. It'll be great for union workers. By the end of the 60s, they had changed their mind. They saw what was happening in terms of import competition. They saw what was happening in terms of companies being able to locate in lower wage places outside the United States. And they've fought this kind of losing rearguard action against trade ever since. And we've watched the union membership shrink quite dramatically. I argue that they played a weak hand poorly, that there's more that they could have done to try to influence U.S. policy. But the unions really, I think, you know, if you want to point to the biggest losers from America's integration into the global economy, it's been the labor unions here in the United States. And they continue to fight, but they're a smaller and smaller voice. Mm-hmm.
I thought your example of Caterpillar, and I mentioned it before, was such a great analysis of what's really happening out there when it comes to companies that are going abroad and who's losing jobs and who's gaining jobs. Could you walk us through what's happened to Caterpillar over the last 30 or 40 years and how that really does demonstrate the point that I think you're trying to make here about our trade policies and their impact on workers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Caterpillar in a lot of ways is a great success story, right? It's a big global manufacturer. It was one of the American companies that very early on figured out that if it was going to compete, it needed to make things all over the world. It needed to be able to export all over the world. You know, it took our car companies, for instance, a lot longer to figure that out. Caterpillar also recognized that it actually needed real help from the federal government. I mean, the company almost got driven out of business in the 1980s because the Japanese yen was so weak that Japanese competitors almost drove Caterpillar out of business. And it ended up actually getting a lot of help from the Reagan administration when the Reagan administration negotiated to lower the value of the U.S. dollar, really helped Caterpillar, probably saved it from bankruptcy. And so in a lot of ways, Caterpillar is a success story. But if you look at its U.S. footprint, you know, the number of workers it employs here in the United States, it's fallen steadily over the years. And they've also squeezed their labor force really hard. They've said, look, you know, we've got to be competitive in the global market and we can't afford to pay really high union wages to all our workers. So Caterpillar was a pioneer in these two-tier wage agreements with the unions where older workers, you know, say make $28 or $30 an hour, but new hires are coming in at $12 or $15 an hour. Caterpillar's been willing to do lockouts in the United States to force the unions into these wage concessions. So it's really, you know, like a lot of the things I write about in my book, it's a complicated story. I mean, on one level, Caterpillar is a great American success story. But in terms of the benefits to its workforce, to the benefits of the United States generally, it's I think, providing less and less over the years.
And that's because of its global impact and the fact that it's now building all of these plants and factories in other parts of the world, obviously not employing American workers anymore. I mean, how American is the company anymore?
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, most of these companies will say, you know, we are global companies headquartered in the United States. And I think, you know, realistically, Caterpillar probably didn't have a choice if it wanted to succeed. What worries me a little bit, I think, is that big companies have lost sight of the fact that they actually do owe something to the United States, not just out of good corporate citizenship, though I would like to see more of that. But they really need the U.S. government defending their interests around the world. And I think if they're expecting that out of the U.S. government, then they need to think very much about what they're providing here in the United States. Are they creating good jobs here in the United States? Are they contributing in a robust way to the American economy? So that it really does make sense for the U.S. government to go to bat for them when they run into problems, say, in China or Mexico or other parts of the world. One of the things that I hope, you know, if we can get off some of the scandal stuff that we've seen, one of the things that I hope the Trump administration will succeed in doing is forcing American companies to think a little more seriously about their obligations to the United States. I was one of the few here in Washington think tank circles who wasn't sorry to see Donald Trump going after the Carrier Corporation and saying, hey, you know, if you're going to move these jobs to Mexico, there's going to be a price to pay. I think more American companies need to be thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is Edward Alden, author of Failure to Adjust. The book looks at the impacts of globalization on the American economy and what we need to do to compete more effectively. So you have a chapter in your book on the U.S. corporate tax, and this isn't too far removed from what you're talking about right now, because there's no doubt that the United States is losing investment and revenue as a result of these taxes. Could you walk us through? This is a difficult argument for some because, of course, for some, the corporate tax could never be enough.
Yeah, let me try to sort of keep it as simple as I can. I mean, corporate tax is one of the big things that drives investment locations. So if companies are going to invest in, you know, the U.S. or Canada or Ireland or wherever they're looking at, the level of corporate taxes matters a lot. You go back to the mid-1980s, the United States had a sort of corporate tax rate that was roughly in the middle of the advanced economies. Today, because every other economy has been cutting its corporate tax to try to attract investment, the U.S. has the highest top line corporate tax rate. The U.S. tax system is even slightly worse because there are many benefits in the U.S. tax code for companies that invest offshore. Basically, as simply as I can put it, U.S. companies do not actually have to pay U.S. tax unless they bring their offshore profits home, which most companies don't do. They just hold the money offshore. Apple's got a $260 billion cash pile offshore right now. And so our tax code is screwed up in two ways. Our corporate tax rate's too high, and there are a lot of incentives for companies to earn money through investment abroad, to move their profits overseas, and to hold the dollars there. What I argue in the book is that we really should be lowering our corporate tax rate and actually moving to a consumption tax, what's called the value-added tax that every other advanced economy uses, which actually, for reasons that go way back into the history of this, are very beneficial in trade terms. You know, say we paid a 5% consumption tax, you can rebate that when you export a product and it gets charged on imports. The Republicans in Congress are actually talking about a version of this now. It's called the border adjusted tax. It has, I don't like it as much as a simple value added tax, but the purpose is somewhat the same, to actually try to increase the relative advantages of investing in the United States and exporting from the U.S. as opposed to investing overseas and importing back to the United States. So there are parts of that that I actually quite like.
Is that a simple Democrat versus Republican problem, or does it break down more complicated in the U.S. Congress?
I mean, I think it kind of has been, but I don't think it should be. You know, if you're a Democrat and you're worried, say, about, you know, jobs for union voters or jobs for the working classes that have historically been an important part of the Democratic voter base, then you should actually want a lower corporate tax rate that encourages companies to invest in the United States. There is the question of offsets, of course, because the government needs revenue for other things that matter for competitiveness, education and infrastructure and investment in research and development. So, you know, governments need to find other ways to raise money. I do think this has broken down on partisan lines. The Democrats are, for my taste, really, they see the corporations too much as the problem. I actually think the corporations need to be part of the solution. And I think that there is the potential here for bipartisanship. But unfortunately, in Washington, it's been hard to produce much of any bipartisanship on anything.
Mm-hmm. So I think your book says at last check, there was a $350 billion trade deficit with China. Let's talk a little bit about China and how it acts when it comes to allowing market access to imports.
China is better than Japan was. China actually imports a fair bit. A lot of it are intermediate components that are then assembled for final export. The classic example is Apple's iPhone, which is assembled in southern China. It's got components from all over the world. So a fair bit of what China imports is for eventual export. There are kind of two big problems in China. One is that the whole economy is just so investment and export focused. You know, if the Chinese would actually encourage their people to consume a bit more, to, you know, buy American agricultural products and buy American manufactured products, buy American movies, that would actually really help us in terms of selling into China. And the Chinese government, for a variety of reasons, does not really do that. The other problem, which is going to become bigger over time, is that China really subsidizes and uses regulations to favor its own companies in a lot of different sectors, from steel to aluminum to solar panels, increasingly to semiconductors. And the problem here is that it floods the world market, drives down prices, and really crowds out a lot of what would otherwise be successful American industries. So there are some big issues on the horizon with China. The new U.S. Trade Representative, Bob Lighthizer, understands this set of issues pretty well. I think there's going to be some interesting discussions between the U.S. and China in the coming months.
Now, when it comes to those semiconductors, we know a little bit about that. We're the home here in Idaho of Micron Technology, and Hewlett-Packard also has a presence here. And the one thing that really grabbed my attention when you were discussing this issue in your book is the fact that in some cases China requires companies moving in to sell their wares to actually share their proprietary technology. And I have to – you can please explain that, first of all. And then secondly, are we any good at that over here? I suppose not.
I mean, we don't do that. Yeah. I mean, it's – unfortunately, it's not just in some cases. It seems to be in most cases. You know, you talk to U.S. corporate executives and what the Chinese are interested in is developing their own indigenous capabilities. So, you know, if you want to be in the semiconductor business in China, you need to partner with a Chinese company. And the result is that they're going to learn a lot of your trade secrets and eventually they're going to become a competitor. And it's this absolute catch-22 for American companies because they feel like they have to be present in China. It's the largest market in the world and is growing you know, ever larger every day. They don't feel like they can be frozen out. And yet the Chinese demand as the price of entry this technology sharing, which in even the midterm is really going to erode the advantages that U.S. companies have. This is one of those problems, again, that is not going to get solved without an active government role. I mean, Micron there has been a big beneficiary of government action over many years. I have a big section in my book on the semiconductor industry in the face of Japanese and also Korean competition in the 1980s. And sometimes American industries really need help because other governments are helping their industries. And if we look the other way, we're going to lose out. And semiconductors has really been a classic example of that. And fact is, our semiconductor industry is a big, important and successful employer in the United States. So we need to be paying attention to it.
Well, it just seems after reading your book that in so many ways we've looked the other way and we've failed through successive presidential administrations to get this right. And I really hope your book has an impact in it. And it shows you, in the case of Trump anyway, he might have been onto something when it comes to at least reevaluating. He has made some changes. I think he had some executive orders. Are those to the good, as far as your argument is concerned, or not?
You know, I think it's honestly too early to tell. The trade policy of this administration has been unfolding very slowly, but I think there are clearly good things you could do in a NAFTA renegotiation. I actually hope he takes another look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership because I thought that would have been an important point of leverage against China. I think the administration is generally sending a signal that it's going to be tougher on this issue of government subsidies, particularly in China. I'm encouraged by that. So I think it's far too early to draw any definitive conclusions, but I think some of the things the administration is talking about are moving in the right direction.
Ted, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the book is Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. The author is Edward Alden, who's visited with us this last half hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Edward Alden. Next week, Craig Johnson, author of The Western Star, the 13th book in the best-selling Longmire mystery series. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to previous interviews anytime, download our free app from Google Play or the App Store. Just search for Reader's Corner.